The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
People of Earth, if you can hear my voice, you have arrived at another episode of Breakfast with Brent Pope. I am your host, Brent Pope. My guest today is, once again, writer for TV and film, Guy Busick. You know him from Ready or Not, the fabulous horror comedy that came out a couple years ago. You know him from Castle Rock, Stand Against Evil. He's written on all these things. He's got some other projects coming out that we're going to talk about. The new Scream, we might talk about a little bit. Are you guys interested in that? A little ghost face talk? And we also had Breakfast from Heirloom Cafe in Toluca Lake. So, let's talk horror comedy, because it's Guy Busick 2, Secret of the Ooze, Electric Boogaloo, today on Breakfast.
Pick it up!
Welcome to Breakfast with Brent Pope. Breakfast.
This young lady just smashed the lids on all these cakes in the bakery section.
That could go on a Hallmark card.
My guest today...
Oh, I'm going to need to hear all about that.
I didn't need any extra sausage.
He adds character to my crew.
Is a goat pit a real thing?
Welcome to Breakfast with Brent Pope.
Great place to hang out and good food, too. I'm always playing blue-collar guys.
Breakfast. Let me screw through the pipe.
I wouldn't jump up and down until we stabilized the hydraulics.
I love a crawler. Yeah. All my uncles got the gout. Jalapeno / cheddar waffles.
Who doesn't love that? It's Breakfast time.
Breakfast.
The only show where bacon, pancakes, Hollywood. I'm your host, Brent Pope.
Yeah, that's my go-to.
There should really be a Secret of the Ooze Electric Boogaloo. I mean, just like a sequel on top of a sequel that are two different movies.
The other go-to of mine is The New Batch. You can add The New Batch to almost anything.
Is that Gremlins 2, The New Batch?
It is.
God, that is funny. What are some of the... welcome to the show, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming back.
It's good to be back. It's an honor to be your first return guest.
Oh, well, thank you. Mark that on the tape. Marco.
When you asked me to come back, I was like, oh, you're still doing that? I'm
what's
kidding.
Name,
I kid.
What's the name again? And what's your last name?
Yeah. Who's this?
Anyway, welcome. Welcome back.
I feel like
studio.
This is the new and improved Breakfast because it's now with more hair.
You caught me right in the middle drinking water.
I was going for the spit take, but didn't land it.
I didn't want a spit take right on my... I chose to die.
That's my mission today.
Instead of spit take.
That was attempt number one, but there will be more.
That's the name of the new Bond, I think, too. To die while spit taking. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say to die with more hair.
Oh, to die with more hair.
Yeah.
Interesting. And the villain is called Morehair, and it's just like literally a Bigfoot.
Titus Morehair.
Titus Morehair. Well, Mr. Bond, not expecting someone so hirsute.
Oh, I love that word.
That means hairy, guys.
The way I remember it and its meaning is it sounds like hair suit.
It
like
does
like you're wearing
sound
a hair
like
suit.
Hair
so it's a nice little trick, nice little tool.
You know what hair suit is when you translate it into Indonesian? Chewbacca.
So I don't get it.
Yeah, me neither. Somebody told me that. I was like, Guy, I'll get this joke. I don't. Well, Guy, you were known for being an irritating part of my life. A very good friend, in all honesty. And we go back a long ways. We go back all the way to before we were in Los Angeles, I guess.
Yeah, we met in Nebraska.
You went to Pepperdine out here.
I did.
How'd you end up at Pepperdine? I don't know if we've ever talked about that.
Yeah, it was, I went on a, for the theater school, I was, I auditioned at a thespian festival in Muncie, Indiana, which my high school went to every summer. And yeah, when I was a junior, I auditioned for a whole bunch of schools and got a few callbacks, and Pepperdine was one of the more aggressive ones. And, you know, coming from Nebraska, I saw pictures of the campus right on the beach in Malibu, and I was like, yes, please.
So you're known for writing a lot of horror, I would say horror-type comedy. Type stuff. Do you think that's fair to say?
I would say that's fair. I think it's scary stuff with some hopefully some laughs in there.
Was that something you really wanted to do? Was that something that just kind of happened and then you're like, oh, well, I'm really good at this? Does it go back to what you liked as a kid?
Not really. I was not a horror guy. I was into comedies that had some scares in them though, like your Ghostbusters or your your Gremlins that were could be a little intense when you were a kid.
Right.
But they were mostly comedies. So, yeah, I guess you could trace some of it back to that. And then Scream was a big influence on me when it came out in 96.
Yeah.
It was the first time I was like, oh. Because I was not a big 80s horror guy, like the slashers, the franchises. Yeah. I enjoy them now, but I wasn't at the time like super into them. And Scream was like, oh, I actually care about these characters. The characters are smart. They are referencing, you know, horror movies and the rules. And it was just like, it kind of changed everything. It kind of blew my mind open and was like, oh, this can be, it can be fun. You don't have to, you know, just be gross and gory. You can have that, but, there's, you can do more than one thing with one movie.
Yeah. It really is the first thing I remember anyway, that was like that, where it was a horror film where they did really dig into the characters, and it wasn't just like this bad guy and then that's killing people and you're like, oh no, who's going to die next type deal.
It was more than just caricatures. You actually did care if they lived or died.
But it's also very funny while still being very violent.
Yeah, very violent.
You know? And anytime you can see someone like making the Jiffy Pop on the stove, it's pretty great. I mean, it's just like, isn't that not like the coolest thing though? It's totally, I would never make that now because why?
Did you ever do that? Did you ever have that particular Jiffy Pop?
No.
I don't know anyone who had it in real life, but I'd see it in movies and like, what is that?
Yeah, it's like, wow.
They must be rich.
How the other half lives making popcorn on their stove.
What am I doing with this stupid fucking bag in the microwave? I'm a schmuck.
There's something about, look.
This doesn't have a handle.
Does it really taste any better? I mean, I think it tastes better that it took me 80 seconds to make. Let me ask you this. I mean, if we're talking about microwave popcorn, like, this is interesting because I feel like when we were younger, you would make that stuff, and no matter how long you cooked it, at least 10% of the kernels are still in there.
Yeah, just absolutely.
And now, like, when I make these things, at most, there's two kernels left in there that aren't cooked.
The technology has improved.
Is it just like the farmers and the engineering, the biological engineering is so great? Or is, I don't know what it is.
I mean, maybe it's chemicals you're ingesting. I don't know.
What was the first thing you ever acted on? Did you want to be an actor when you were young, like as a performer? Or did that come a little later?
Right off the bat. I did like community theater when I was a kid. And then when we started, you know, what, eighth grade, I think, we were allowed to do drama class. And then I auditioned for stuff. And we just said, try it out at that age.
Right.
I'm trying out for that part. Yeah, just really enjoyed it. And then all through high school, all through college, and then a little bit after. But yeah, the writing kind of picked up before that did. And so I kind of switched gears.
Yeah. Well, I've seen you act in... So, no, I mean, we were in a sketch
waiting
group.
For it now.
We were in a sketch group together. You were very good, despite my character, like my role being just... shitting on you the entire show, basically.
You were my nemesis in the show.
Mm-hmm. But I've seen you in other plays. You're a very good actor. I think that's one of the reasons you are great at dialogue, because you have that other side where you are an actor. You know what I mean? You see the other side of it, and you... I don't know. Do you think that's related?
I absolutely do. And it also helps with pitches. Just having a performance background, you know, and kind of like being able to read the room, you know, adjust your performance. Because pitching is like the only performance I get to do anymore. And so I tend to like act out all the parts and do the voices. And
it's
fun for me. Like it's stressful.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy the actual pitch.
That's very interesting. I did not. This is something I'm thinking of as you're saying it. So when you're saying when you're pitching a show or you're pitching yourself as a writer, that you're kind of, you're able to have the consciousness to read the room and adjust your performance. That's pretty crazy.
If you, I mean, people, you know, read body language, if you know, just like with a bad audience, if you're, you know, theater or stand up, I assume, where it's just like, okay, you got to pick up the pace, you know, jump over this part because you're losing them. Or if something was hitting, you know, keep mentioning that or circle back in a fun way. But yeah, I think it's all about just engaging the audience, whether it's any kind of performance.
Well, I'm looking forward to Scream, which you co-wrote, I believe.
I co-wrote with a good friend, James Vanderbilt.
Yes. Very nice guy.
Yeah. We've been friends many, many decades at this point. Well, not many decades. Almost.
What's many?
Let's see.
Three?
Let's
three's
say almost
many.
Almost three.
Yeah, three's many.
But he's a good friend, and we've been partners on many things where he's produced things of mine.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was thrilled to be... included in this project. It was a great experience. It's the first Scream with no killers.
Yeah.
And everyone just gets along. Oh, shit. I shouldn't have.
Oh, well, you heard it here first, guys. I'm going to put that on the live Instagram feed right now.
Crap. my career's over. No, I literally cannot say anything about it other than that it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Got to work with one of my writing idols, Kevin Williamson, who was kind of the godfather of this whole thing. And I think it turned out fantastic, and I'm really excited for it to come out next January and for people to see it.
Okay. Well, let me ask you questions, and if you can't answer it, you just can't answer it, right?
Oh, this will be fun.
No. So when you're writing Scream, you and James are writing it, are you writing scenes together? Are you writing individual scenes?
When we're breaking the script, when we're kind of like beating it out, we would be in the same room. And sometimes we would improvise dialogue, action, stuff like that. And that was the more collaborative part.
Yeah.
And then just for efficiency, after we had a really robust outline, we would just split up scenes.
Okay.
And so I would take this section, you know, these 10 pages, he would take this, and then we'd swap and kind of do a pass on each other's stuff. And then, you know, by the end of it, it feels like one person wrote it. It feels very consistent. And we have very similar voices, I think, as writers and sensibilities. And so it was a really good fit.
Is there ever a time when you're kind of going through and you're like, okay, I think one of us has the better take on this one dialogue of this one character. So you kind of take the lead on a certain character?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, there were certain characters that... Yeah, we just, one of us would have more of an affinity for, and so we'd be like, could you do this speech?
Well, before we go any further, Guy,
yeah.
Guy Busick, we had breakfast from Heirloom Cafe in Toluca Lake.
Uh-huh.
Heirloom, like the heirloom tomato, I assume that's how it sounds, but it's spelled A-E-I-R, loom.
It's an unusual spelling.
As if maybe they were fans of, like, the last airbender or aeronautics engineer, but also maybe it was like an aeronautics engineer that engineered an heirloom tomato that was more aerodynamic.
I don't know.
For cooking.
It was quite tasty.
It really was. And it was a nice little outdoor. It reminded me a little bit of like if you're in Europe and you're sitting at a little cafe, kind of.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it was very pleasant. And we had a nice mister above us. It was a hot day.
That mister, like, I didn't notice it at first.
I never caught his last name.
Sorry, we had to cut that guy. You had the what they call the sunny sandwich.
The sunny sandwich. It was.
And what was that?
A couple eggs sunny side up. So you had a nice runny yolk. We had some Gruyere cheese in there, which was delicious, and some heirloom tomatoes, which I assume is a signature of theirs, and bacon.
Yeah.
It was really good.
It looked really good, actually.
A side of fruit.
I think we talked about this. I never seem to see Gruyere cheese just on its own, right? Or have you seen it like on a charcuterie board? I don't think I have.
I'm not great at identifying the cheeses by sight.
But by taste, you tasted it, right?
But I'm saying I'm looking at like five cheeses. Am I going to know what they are? I mean,
that's
I could pick out Brie. I could pick out Swiss.
That's true. There may be Gruyere. I guess I'm so used to having it melted that I probably wouldn't identify it either.
Yeah. Also, I have cheese blindness. It's a
thing. It's a thing.
It's really embarrassing. I mean, you've got your tooth thing. I've got
cheese
blindness.
No one wants to. You've talked about that every day.
Well,
for us CBers, what is that cheese blind? Oh, yeah, the cheese blind thing again.
I got to go to CBA.
Guy uses this as an excuse. I'll come to his house. He's just eating a loaf of Velveeta, and he's like, I thought it was Brie. I thought it was Glad. Look, it's not my fault.
Guy, it comes in sleeves.
That's right.
You had to unwrap all of them.
That's
you had
right.
to know.
I thought it was French.
My cheese shame. Jeez.
So I had the...
Spicy tomato.
The spicy tomato, which was highly recommended. It was like a...
It was.
Organic sautéed tomato with three... It was basically like scrambled eggs with like tomato mixed in it.
Mm-hmm.
Sautéed and some serrano pepper, some green pepper, some basil, feta, Persian cucumbers. Those were kind of on the side.
Let's go back to that basil.
Basil Rathbone, the guy that played Sherlock Holmes in the 1950s. It was Basil. It was his bones ground into dust and sprinkled over.
This is a strange choice, culinary choice.
Yeah, well, you know, if you buy Basil Rathbone bones, you gotta use them for something. I mean. So it's, I guess, what they call like a wet omelet, and I don't know if that's a French. Yeah, I don't know if they call that a French thing, but it was meant to be like kind of dipped in the baguettes.
It didn't look I'm just going to say it. I mean, it's
right.
I'm sure it was delicious. Didn't try it. You offered and I just was like, I don't know.
No, you're right. And I'm not saying this is a slam on it. The wet omelet might be a thing in France or something. But if I feel like if I was watching like Matt, if I was watching Gordon Ramsay, who would have been like, that looks like a dog's dinner. And then he'd be like, but it tastes bloody good. Yeah. You know, like one of those things.
I mean, you finished it, but then you're the clean plate
But then again, I'm a clean plate club. Yeah. I was hoping
is
to
that
not...
an official club or?
Yes.
How many
Don't
plates? How many
ask
plates you
if
gotta
you can be in it again. You didn't the finish your sandwich last time.
How many plates you got to clean before they give you a little? They
Look,
extend the membership.
It's like when you become a saint. They have to have three miracles of food that you've finished all of.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Just three. Okay.
Mine was chicken wings, including the bones. That was witnessed at Mount Carmel.
Obviously, the popcorn bowl.
And two other ones that I'm not allowed to talk about just because it's a very secret society. It's semi-secret, so I can tell you one of the three. anyway, thank you for going to Heirloom Cafe with me.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thank you for treating.
You're known now as like this, I would say, very successful screenwriter, TV writer, that people kind of know your name. But
I wouldn't.
There was a long time when you were just this close the time. Similar to like when you're an actor, you're this close.
Yep.
And if you're this close, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. Close doesn't count. I mean, I think when Ryan and I came in last time, we talked about how you could make a pretty good living just selling things and working on things that never get made.
Right.
And so people are like, what have you done? And you're like, well, stuff that never got made. So you won't know it. And then I sound like I'm lying. But it was a struggle. I think between the time that I was like, okay, I think I'm going to try to be professional screenwriter and the time that Ready or Not started production, 20 years.
Wow.
So, you know, little minor victories would keep you going.
Right.
You know, but it took me a few years when I started to get my first manager and agent to, you know, get the first thing optioned. And then things started to get a little bit easier. And then Ryan and I would work together off and on, you know, over those years. And it's just what I like when I'm hanging out with other writers is we try to top each other with like the worst experience story.
Yeah.
And it just makes you feel better.
Right.
Because you're like, this isn't just me. We all experience these horrible moments of failure or humiliation or both.
Look, anything that has to do with you failing, I want to hear about it all day. That way
it's
I
like
can...
food for you.
It's food for me.
For your black,
I'm
black
like a,
soul.
Yeah, I'm like a failure vampire. Yeah. I take in your
That's
failure.
Why you've been hanging out with me for so long.
You notice now that you're getting a bunch of big movies that you're getting done, I'm withering away into dust.
Yeah, well, you're like, oof.
When is that next big failure
I was going to say something. Oh, no, they believe me, they still happen frequently. But a couple of my worst moments that I always love hearing these stories, so I'll share them. So Ryan and I were working with a pair of writer-producers on a TV show pitch, and these guys were pretty big deals, and they had a deal at a network, and so we couldn't shop it around. We had to pitch it to they had an exclusive deal. And according to them and their reps and our reps, it was a slam dunk. And so the morning of the pitch, we were all waiting in the waiting area for an unusually long time. Oh, like, what's unusual? Like, probably more than 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And we're like...
That seems like a long time.
Yeah. It's, you know, 10 minutes. You're like, okay, that's normal. But this was like, I wonder what's going on. So we went in and pitched this guy who was the head of the network and a good friend of these writers. And he'd worked with them for many years on many projects. And there was just something off. The vibe in the room was terrible. And what was supposed to be a formality pitch turned into one of the worst pitches we'd ever had, because like the questions weren't just like, oh, and what is this character? It was almost hostile. You know, like there was just something wrong. Like, why would he be angry? So I got home and looked on Deadline, and I found out that minutes before we went into the room, he had found out that he didn't get the job that he was supposed to get, and someone else had gotten it. It was like a bigger job at an affiliated network. And so the guy was just going to say no to everything for a week. I was like, oh, cool. That was great
timing.
And then, there was a rough patch and, you know, kind of leading up to, there were many moments in the 20 years that were like, how long am I going to keep doing this?
Yeah.
You know, because success in my mind was getting something made that I actually liked.
Yeah.
And until that happened, you know, it didn't matter that, you know, I could sell a pitch or a script or whatever, because it just kept not getting made. But one of the low points was Ryan and I had just been fired from two jobs in the same week. And pretty quickly after, I was looking on, again, Deadline, And I see the news that our agent had moved from our current agency to, I think, ICM, one of the big three. And so I look, I'm looking at my cell phone, and I'm like,
guys, if you can see my face right now, it's like, oh, dear God, what's going
to
happen?
He's doing this.
Yeah. Yep.
Look, yeah, and it's like, clearly we did not. That was how we found out that we'd been dropped.
Wow.
And coming, you know, that was one of the moments where it was like, maybe that's it. Maybe this just is not going to happen. But, you know, it's like a good writer friend of mine and I always say, it's like you're only one good script away from being, you know, back in the game or back on top, however you want to put it. But what happened there is there was a misunderstanding because that agency hadn't dropped us. Just that guy didn't take us with him.
Ah.
And so when another agent that we had worked with at that agency bumped into my manager, was like, I haven't heard from them for a while. You know, like, what are they? And it was like, oh, we're still clients there. And in rapid succession, like, there was a project that we were working on that we were going to abandon. And we decided to finish it. And that was the thing that turned things around for us and gave us momentum.
Awesome.
And then within a few weeks of that, we got a call from Jamie, actually, mm-hmm. who had passed Ready or Not, the script. This is like 2014.
Yeah.
On to Trip Vinson, who eventually became another producer on it and was like, Trip really wants to do this. He'd like to come on board. And that's, you know, just, it's such a rocky path, but things change just on a dime. If you just stick with it and you keep producing material, you know, you never know what can happen.
Right.
But yeah, those were some rough ones.
Yeah, I feel like if, obviously this is something that's like, it's not a hard and fast rule, but like, if you are putting out good stuff and you just keep going, you don't get to the point where you just quit, that something good's going to happen at some point, but you got to just keep pushing through.
Yeah.
Kind of, right?
Yeah, it's perseverance and it's learning. It's admitting that you don't know everything, that you can always improve things. It's, you know, not being ambivalent about notes.
Right.
Taking notes well and thinking, even if I don't agree with that note, where did it come from? There's always a kernel of something, in even the worst note. There's always something behind it that you're like, well, something's wrong with this scene or character or just structure, plot, whatever, and they may not be pinpointing it, but they're sensing that there's something wrong. And so you kind of have to do a little diagnostic on it and be like, well, what is the thing that's wrong and how do I fix it? And that's how you keep learning.
Yeah. Well, this is sparking a lot of questions for me, I guess, as you're saying this. So one, you had talked about the time you were in and you knew that the pitch was just not going well. So are there specific strategies? I know you talked about maybe some of you would act stuff out, but if something's going awry and you're like, I think I can still save it, what are some of the things that you kind of try?
You know, the ones that are like just total bombs, you're just fucked.
you just try to get through it.
Just try to get off the stage, essentially. Yeah, and just like don't get, you know, flop sweat if you can help it, and just be like, and there you go.
Then at the end, you're like, that's my time. Thanks, guys. I'm Guy Busick.
Yeah, it's just, oh, it's death. And like Zoom pitches too can be really weird because you can't, you don't have as good a read on the vibe.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are just stone faced on these things.
Right.
And sometimes even in the room,
they're frozen, guy.
Maybe the technology. Yeah, the internet connection went bad. But no, I hate that. As a writer, that's the worst. And that's another thing that writers complain about to each other is like, so-and-so is just completely expressionless, emotionless, doesn't give away what they think. And sometimes, surprisingly, they loved it.
Yeah.
But you'd never know in the moment. And it's just so disheartening because you're just trying to get some reaction from some cool moment.
Right.
And just like impress them. And you're just, you know, tap dancing and then... and then there's people who are like super animated and it's like, oh, they're laughing in the right spots and they're like gasping and reacting in all the right ways. And then it's like an immediate pass.
Right.
Even in the room, it can be like, here's why we're not going to buy this, or here's why you're not the right guy for it. And it's like, whoa, I really misread that. So sometimes you just can't tell.
Right.
But I think it's all about, you know, you just push through.
Right.
And if they are someone that, you know, was engaged and you're losing them, then it's just like, get through it faster, jump to the thing.
Right.
The next big signpost in the story, like what's the next cool set piece, what's the next big joke or horror moment or scare.
I understand that person in some ways. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I understand the guy that doesn't give away all the reactions, because I hear the same thing when people go to audition for Saturday Night Live, right?
Oh wow.
That they intentionally do not laugh. If you get a laugh during the SNL audition, it's like somebody
very rare, huh?
Yeah, it's very rare. Or so, but I guess because they want to see if you can persevere. What's your thought?
What your character was
Let's say on SNL, what that character was, and if you really have a strong take, or if you're just like living off of the laugh, because sometimes that's not going to happen during the show and you have to push through and try to get that next spicy meatball line.
It does make sense. But as a performer, it's death.
It's tough. That's one of those things that you probably learn, though, by doing pitches. How many pitches would you say you did in a room before you felt kind of comfortable?
Oh, dozens.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't relax into it. Because here's the thing about, like, when you're not making it, when you're struggling.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Whether it's a pitch or a spec script or an interview to be on a, you know, a staff writer or whatever. I worked, here's a small list of day jobs.
Yeah.
Forklift driver.
Really?
Background investigator for a government contractor.
I knew that.
Legal assistant at two different movie studios, which was really, really hard because my boss would be negotiating contracts for writers. And I'd see the numbers in the contract and I'm making, you know, peanuts to be an assistant. And I'm looking at like these $1 million contracts for these writers. And I'm just like, oh, that's demoralizing. And then I became a word processor, which I didn't even really know what it was at these law firms. It's even hard to describe now, even though I did it for on and off for 10 years, depending on the writing work.
It was like becoming a transformer, but on a much smaller level, you became this like little thing that just made it wasn't like a giant machine. It was just like
just
people
a little
just
guy.
Come type on you.
Yeah. I would just, yeah.
This guy music machine is great.
It's, but it smells. but I guess, yeah, my point is that when you're working a day job, and I always had to. I didn't have, you know, means to live on if I wasn't working another job. And so basically you're working two jobs. And so you're working 16-hour days and then trying to, you know, get some sleep and also have a social life or be present for your partner. And every script, every pitch had the world attached to it. It's if this goes, I get out of the day job and I get to do this for a living. If this doesn't go, I'm stuck. And it felt like jail, you know, which it's stupid because, you know, I was coming from a place of privilege where I had job. I was able to find work, non-writing work. I'm very grateful for that. But at the time, it just feels like, and then, you know, your friends are making it. They're quitting their jobs or, you know, they never had to work a job. And you're just kind of like, is it ever going to happen for me? And it's very difficult. And once... I think, honestly, for me, I wish I could go back in time and say, guy, don't think of it like that and try to relax and then you'll just do better.
Right.
You'll write better. You'll write more because you won't be so attached to every single goddamn sentence or scene. Or in a pitch, you could relax into it and that just exudes confidence. And that's what they want.
Yeah.
They want someone who feel, you know, they can tell this guy's going to be able to, you know, take notes, do a good job.
Right.
He has confidence. But I don't know if I would have listened. I don't, because it's just so life and death at that point. I mean, not really. Obviously, that's hyperbole, but I guess when I finally
had... But it feels like life or death as far as it's your... As far as your writing goes, it feels like the life or death of your writing career.
Yeah, you just think if this one doesn't go, I'm probably going to quit. And then it sends you down the spiral of, well, then what do I do with my life?
Yeah.
But after I had some moderate successes where it's like I sold, a pitch or a script and I built up a few of those experiences, then it was like the world isn't hinging on this one thing. I've got a few irons in the fire and I have the experience and the practice now of pitching that I'm, you know, a little bit better in the room. And that's huge. It's just do I want to work with this person is almost as important, like personality wise,
right,
as the pitch or the product. Because life's too short. They don't want to hire difficult people.
Right.
Or awkward people. They want someone who can just, they can trust and just say, here's the money, go do your job.
Yeah, I think 80% of this whole thing, whether it's writing, acting, is showing that you can, let's say, be on set with people and act like a normal person.
Just be a normal person.
And also that you're not a dick.
Just, you're not a dick.
Or at least you can hide that you're a dick well enough.
And that's another thing is taking notes. When you're not successful, every note feels like they just shot you in the chest because you're like, oh, my God. Because you just start to panic and go, they don't like it. I'm going to fail. I'm not good at this. I don't know how to fix the thing they're talking about. And it makes you defensive, which makes you difficult. And when you get that label, which I'm sure in my early days I had because I didn't know how to take notes well.
Right.
Because it was like, oh, you're attack. It feels like they're attacking you.
Yeah.
And it's like... No, that's another thing I would go back in time and say, like, just fucking take notes well, you know, just nod and smile and then do it or don't, you know, but in the room, just be cool, be a you know, a normal person, which was a lesson I will say I learned pretty quick.
Do you ever get into like, because it reminds me of some of the stuff I read in, which is very like Eastern philosophy style book, the Four Agreements. I don't know if you've ever read that.
Oh, yeah, I think I did a long time ago.
But, you know, it's got that whole thing where like, don't take things personally.
Yep.
That's really hard for me.
Yeah, me too.
And it, I think it's, one, it's like, it's almost like you're an, it, we all have some type of egocentrism to us where they think everything's about us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's why you take things personally. It's like, oh, they, when you say that, you're personally attacking me. That's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where anyone's come from, like that one guy. He wasn't personally attacking you. He found out he wasn't getting the job, so he was just being a dick to everybody.
Right. Yeah, you know? Exactly. Well, and I think, you know, for every creative person that I know, there are varying degrees of this. Some people are much more centered and sort of mature, but it's like for most of us, I think there is like a dual existence of thinking, I am the best at this and no one else can do what I do.
Yeah.
And you have to have enough of that to just keep going through all of the failure. And I'm the worst piece of shit that's ever been on this planet. Like,
yeah.
I'm the worst at this. I'm a fraud. They're going to find me out. They're going to kick me out of the club. Yeah, I still feel that. And writers who are 100 times more successful than me, I know they do too. They told me, you know, it's like every time you're like, how do I do this again? It's like staring at that blank page, whether it's something you've had in your head for years or, you know, a new project, whatever it is, that blank page is just like, oh, fuck, am I going to remember how to do this?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, coming from the acting side of it, I've, no matter how many TV shows I've shot now, I don't know, 20, whatever it is, anytime I go like a couple months and I haven't booked one, I was like, yeah, I guess they found out I'm a goddamn fraud.
Yeah,
you know,
we all know.
Well, that's it.
Yeah,
and then you get one little success, and you're like, "Yeah, I am good."
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
Like, and then you go, you know, a couple of months again. Well, done with that.
Done with that. Yeah. And I still, you know, it lessens. You know, as you start, like, I'm sure for you booking things, like it's probably less than it was, and your brain kind of can reach for the data that's like, oh, but I've done it before, so I'm probably capable of it, and I can probably do this again. My brain, at least, has gotten better about that, as opposed to just the cold panic of like, oh, no, that you've been found out. I still get it, but I think it's less, which is, I guess, the only encouragement I can offer anyone is that, like, you know, if you just have to, you know, I don't know, you have to remember the times you did do it and that you did do it well and just go, well, if I was capable of it once, I'm capable of it again.
I'm curious your thought. Do you think when I'm acting, maybe half the time I'm like, okay, yeah, I was definitely the best person for a job. And sometimes you're like, well, maybe I fit in a certain slot that they wanted. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just, I mean, I feel like there's a lot more weird luck involved in the acting side as opposed to the writing side where I feel like they're more like, this is the best person for, I don't know. Am I wrong? Are they both that kind of haphazard at some points?
I think they are pretty similar, to be honest. And here's the difference. And this is not like, oh, poor writers.
No.
By any means. But I will say that one difference that is actually, I think there's pros and cons to auditioning versus pitching.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
When you're pitching on a job where it's like, here's an open writing assignment for this big movie, and we're going to cattle call, you know, 8 people, 10 people in, and you all pitch against each other, and then you make the final three, and then you blah, 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 just basically auditioning, right? With auditions, you find out right then and there or pretty soon after. And the prep time for it is probably not that long. Sometimes it's a cold read and you just find out that at that moment. Sometimes you have a couple days notice, I would assume. It's been a long time since I've auditioned for anything in like TV and film, but for pitches, it's weeks of your life.
Yeah.
You're not getting paid for it. It's free work. You have to beat out the entire movie, all of the characters, all of their arcs. What is the tone? How do you pitch the tone? And then the pitch itself lasts 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, half an hour, maybe, tops. And then you don't get it and you feel like, well, what was that for? I could have been working on a spec during that time. I could have had a written product, but, you know, I just wasted. Sometimes it's 3 weeks, sometimes it's months.
Yeah.
That you have to come back and pitch again. And now it's like, just make these adjustments and then come back. And then you got to, or if you have a pitch that's not on a job, but like you just have a TV pitch you want to take around town, you're pitching the same, you know, 15 networks or places. And it's just exhausting. Sometimes you have 3-4 pitches a day. It just takes it out of you. And then no one buys it. I had a few years ago, this is another kind of low point, I guess, was a few years ago when Ryan and I were exclusively still working together, which we're working together on a bunch of things right now as a team, but also some things with other partners or some things on our own. But he and I just had a really bad summer. It was like 3 TV pitches all in a row, usually to the same executives, all passes on all of it. And that was so many collective months of work. And it was just, and a couple of them were like, well, this is almost a sure thing because of this attachment is really meaningful, and that's going to move the needle, and someone's going to want to work with that person, even if the pitch isn't all the way there. And yeah, I'm looking at my bank account, and my wife and I are like, oh no, you know, like, am I going to have to go back to get another day job? And it's so demoralizing when you have to go back. It's like, I would leave one job in triumph and then 3 months later slink back because whatever I was working on didn't work out.
Right. You know,
it's like, I got just enough money to live on that I could quit, and I had to focus on this job and get it right. And then it doesn't get made or whatever. And you're like, oh God, now I got to go temp at the place I used to make more money at.
Yeah.
And it's so sad. But yeah, a few years ago, I'm just looking at the bank account going, I think I might have to go back. And it had been at that point, I think, at least 3 years I'd been out. I had been exclusively writing for a living. And that's when we got Ryan and I Castle Rock.
Wow.
And they were shooting Ready or Not that fall, but we weren't going to get any money from it because we'd been paid for all of our steps.
Yeah.
And
so you already were paid leading up to it.
Yeah. And sometimes you have like a production bonus in your contract, but I don't know if we did on that. I think it was just a credit bonus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get sole credit or shared credit, you get, you know, X amount of dollars. But on that one, we didn't have a production bonus. So even though it was getting made, I was like, I think I might have to go be a word processor again until the credit determination comes out and I get that little chunk. But Castle Rock kind of saved me. And that was just a few years ago. You know, it's just like now I feel much more comfortable because I can't talk about any of them, but I'm working on, I think, 10 things right now.
Yeah.
Trying to juggle 10 projects.
Great.
Yeah. Only one has been announced, which is this project that I sold a year ago called Reunion. Which is another kind of horror comedy.
Nice.
The other ones I haven't been announced, so I would get in trouble for talking about them.
Of course.
But there's some pretty exciting stuff in there. And then, you know, there are varying degrees of like, oh, is it an IP that people know that I get to work on? Or is it an original idea? I'd like to try to mix those.
Yeah.
It's like I definitely want to get my foot in the door for the bigger IPs and stuff like that, the bigger franchises. But I love original horror. I love original stories. So I'm always trying to keep that going too. And it's like Ready or Not is such a rarity because getting an original idea, I mean, it's easier in horror. Horror never goes away.
Look, if you guys haven't seen Ready or Not, was it 2018 that it came out?
2019
it came out. It was my favorite, not because you were the writer, one of the writers. It was just my favorite movie that came out that year.
Thanks,
I love horror comedies, and this is done at its best.
Well, that was such a stars aligned kind of a situation.
Yeah.
We could not have asked for a better studio, better executives at the studio, better producers, and, of course, Radio Silence, who directed. I mean, everyone just had the same vision for it, and that never happens. And that's why when it came out, I was like, when I saw the first cut, I was like, it would be wonderful if this connected with people. And it did well enough at the box office that it was considered a success. And it would be wonderful if the critics liked it. But the only thing that mattered to me is if I liked it, if I could be proud of it.
Right.
That to me, like I said earlier, was my goal. And, you know, it's like after 20 years of near misses, it was like I could finally exhale because if I died the next day, I could at least feel like I did the thing I came out here to do.
Yeah.
I did it once. I got some points on the board, you know, so like I can always point to it, and if I get down, you know, if I'm having a string of failures, I can always point to that and say, at least you got that one made.
Right.
And you like it.
Yeah.
And so it was wonderful that on top of that, a lot of people did seem to connect with it. And I, you know, I've heard a lot of really nice things from people who are fans, and I, you know, I got to know some of the cast a little bit and crew, and it was just, it's just a wonderful thing. And, you know, I don't think, I mean, I guess I'm leading a charmed, you know, life recently because it was another great experience on Scream.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't happen very often where it's just like, oh, this turned out well, like in a way that I'm proud of it. I like it. I think it's good. I'm just waiting for those first experiences where I'm actually, you know, part of something and it doesn't turn out to be what I want it to be. It's like it's still a win because you got it made.
Yeah.
But man, Ready or Not was just like, that's so rare that from the beginning to the end, everyone was on the same page. Everyone wanted it to be what it became.
Right. Right.
It was really cool. And I'm very grateful.
That's all really cool inside kind of stuff for writers out there and people that are just doing really any kind of entertainment stuff because it's all kind of sometimes the same process. Now, something I hadn't thought about that you said, and I was like, oh, that totally makes sense because I'm not doing those things where someone says, okay, you're doing a pitch on this project and you have to prepare for that project for weeks.
Yeah.
That's just not something you have to do as an actor. You might get something a week ahead of time, but it's not like I have to write it myself, you know?
And, you know, I was talking about pros and cons about both, and I forgot to mention, like, you know, having had the experience as an actor, the cons of going in and doing the thing, not having to prep, you know, for a long, long time, is that it does feel more personal because it's you. It's you, and it's just like it's your physical presence. It's not words on a page. And that was always hard for me because it's like, oh, man, I take things personally as a writer, but as an actor, it was like, you know, feeling physically wounded.
Yeah.
When cause it's like, oh, I'm bad. You know, I'm
yeah.
like they don't like me. And that's not even the case as an actor either, but it was harder for my brain to make that distinction.
I mean, that's the thought process I always have if I'm doing stand-up comedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to sketch comedy, improv comedy, mm-hmm. where there's other people involved, or am I at an audition with a bunch of people, mm-hmm. is that if you go up there and you bomb, they hated you.
They didn't like you.
Yeah.
And I couldn't take it. I mean, honestly, I would love to get back into acting and stuff, and like, I've gotten to play around and you know, I had a little cameo in Ready or Not, which was a blast. And I'd love to, you know, eventually dip a toe back in, but because I think I could probably weather it at this point. But yeah, it was hard when I first got out of college and I was doing auditions for film and TV and commercials and, you know, doing stage work.
Yeah.
Theatrical work. It just beats you down.
I mean, if I were you, I'd be trying to have any kind of workaround to be an actor, which is like, I guess for you might be at some point, hopefully. You do the M. Night thing where you just like write yourself a scene in every movie. This is a fun little, you know, I mean,
honestly, like when I first started writing, I was like, that was the plan. It was like not because I was just like very inspired by, you know, Good Will Hunting. And I'm like, these guys who couldn't quite break through wrote themselves a great script.
Right.
And it changed over time. It became more about the writing in and of itself than like, oh, I still want to act. And the desire's still there, but it's this is what I do now, and I'm comfortable with that. But I think if I didn't take it as seriously, and if I know that I have like this backup career,
right.
Maybe I wouldn't take it so hard. I don't know. Maybe I would.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So here's the one last question I want to ask you about this whole thing that came up while you were mentioning all these great tidbits. As an actor, mm-hmm. I'm used to being, well, not now. Everything's like, we send self-tapes in right now. But
right.
If things go back to where we're in person, I'm going to be in a room and I see like 10 people that I'm auditioning against.
Mm.
When you're going in for your pitches, are you guys overlapping where you see each other?
Rarely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's
because I think executives don't like to hear too many in one day. So yeah, it's not quite the same. And sometimes your manager can get, you know, or your agent can get a little intel on like, who am I pitching against? How many? Like the important thing is how many.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's a big, big number, it might not be worth your time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm getting to a point now where if I hear a certain number, I'm like, I don't think I'm going to go for that.
Right.
It would have to be something that I absolutely had to do.
Yeah.
But if it's like, oh, they went to you and one other person.
Then you're like, okay.
You're like, okay, then they actually specifically wanted to hear what I would do with it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like 8 horror writers.
Yeah.
And that gives me, you know, a little bit more confidence that it's worth the time.
Cool. Well, thanks for all that great inside writing info. I think the people who listen are going to really love this. And I you and I have been friends for a long time and still think we've never talked about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Thanks for withholding all of this info for me. I'm doubting whether we're friends, actually.
Yeah, it's really only from you, too. I talk about this with all of my other friends. And people I don't even know. So I'll just go up to it at a bus stop and just be like, do you want to hear about screenwriting? But not you.
Marco, let's cut all that out that he just said where he minimized our friendship. Let's just leave that out.
You know, when you're wearing a mask, it's easier to Brent Korn.
Before we get out of here, Guy, I need to get 3 quick recommendations from Guy Busick.
Oh, sure.
What is the hidden gem show or movie that you love that people may not know?
I would say there's a Netflix show that's German. It's called Dark. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen. Certainly one of the best in the last decade. And it's equal parts like small town soap drama and science fiction.
Okay.
And I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, but this is, in my opinion, the best long-form time travel.
Oh.
Anything.
Okay.
I've ever seen. And
cool.
It's very, very intricate and complicated, but it's so rewarding. And it's about so many things. It's about, you know, fate. It's about generational trauma. It's very, very, it's like intellectually deep. It's emotionally deep. And I just don't think enough people know about it. I mean, like, I see some people, you know, on, like, writer Twitter or film Twitter or whatever talking about it. But it's like, I would love for more people to see that.
Yeah. God, generational trauma is something I never heard of maybe, like, up until about 6 months ago. And now I hear, and I'm like, it totally makes sense. I just never had thought of it. What is the show or movie that you watch just for fun?
I don't want to minimize these things because I think I get a lot out of it. Everyone at this point has talked about Ted Lasso, but I can't stress enough how much that show just makes me happy. I Think You Should Leave is another one that's obviously very, very popular. But
man,
it's a gift. That show's a gift.
I auditioned for season two, and I really, I don't care what it is. I don't care if I'm a guy just sitting at a table.
And the rewatchability factor of those sketches, because you just pick something up new every single time. I just think it's genius. It makes me very, very happy.
Okay, let me ask you this, because I Think You Should Leave, I also really love. If you have to pick only one sketch of I Think You Should Leave to show people, which one do you pick?
I could pick Carl Havoc from season two.
Okay, that's great.
To me, that was the most popular one. I see it all over Twitter, but it's like, it's just, even though it's so universally lauded and loved, it felt like it was written for me.
It had
everything. It had, you know, the discomfort. It had the self-hate. Yeah. It had borderline suicidal ideations. Or actual suicidal ideations. He just didn't want to be there anymore. And it's like, just the, you know, I got too much shit on me. And the producer telling him to go flip that woman's tray. Yeah. He's like, well, what would that do for the greater good? It's just so many perfect line readings. I don't even want to be around anymore.
I
mean, genius.
That's a great one. I think I probably have to go with the Fully Loaded Nachos.
That's fantastic. Oh, my God.
Tress and I are constantly just like showing, you haven't seen the thing you're leaving. Let me just leave the Fully Loaded Nachos thing.
I mean, just to hook people, I've shown them just the first sketch of the first episode of the first season with the door. The job interview in the door.
That's pretty
great. I'm like, this is the show.
Yes, totally is the show.
My God.
Maybe also the guy that's choking but doesn't want to admit he's choking. That's pretty great. He won't admit that he's choking because there's a cool guy in the room.
Birthday presents, right, with Stephen Young?
Oh, God, yes.
And
the
sloppy mud pie.
Yeah.
And then in this season, too, the guy that goes to the haunted house tour,
right,
because it's the adult one and he can swear. And that payoff at the end of him getting into his mom's car is just like simultaneously hilarious and heartbreaking.
Yeah. Tim Robinson, I Think You Should Leave. Everybody watch that, guys.
Yeah. Everyone does, I hope, already. Yeah. But
What is the show or movie that inspires you?
Oh, well, I guess I would go back to Ted Lasso a little bit.
Okay.
But like, I'm trying to think of like other I'm going to blank on this one, I know. And you sent these to me in advance, and I just was like, I got a few.
Yeah.
Can I pass?
Look, I would say that, I mean, you gave us Ted Lasso, and then you also said it seems like I Think You Should Leave inspires you, because it is slightly, I mean, it's a half tick away from being a horror show also from some of the stuff that happens. It's just like,
it
so
really is.
This guy's going to snap at any moment. So I'm okay with that. If that's, I Think You Should Leave inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I gave you these things ahead of time. You did no prep on the show. Claims that we're friends. Talks about the corn in my teeth for 20 minutes. Pass on it. Fine. That's great. Guys, if you'd like to get more Brentfist stuff, such as picks up Guy Music and I enjoying our Brentfist from Heirloom Cafe, go to my website, brentpope.com. You can listen to all the episodes there. Visit the official Brentfist store with a bunch of fun stuff inside. Shirts, mugs, stickers, headshots of Guy Busick, masks, perfect for holiday gifts. It's all in there. I'm still going to get the Guy Busick headshots up and going. They'll be there. People of Earth, do yourself a favor by picking up something from the Brentfist store. Guy Busick headshots, three for a dollar, coming soon. And if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to Brentfist. Even if you're in, White Deer, Red Deer, what's the place in Canada? They love me there. And they love that I don't know their name. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. Brentfist is being enjoyed all over the United States in 40 other countries. And trust me, my Breakfast Burrito Brigade, we're just getting started. Special thanks to my editor, the one and only Rosemary Brown, for all the Brentfist slicing and dicing. Much preach. Big ups also to my studio engineer, Marco Leon, for making me sound so good. Guy Busick, what is next for you? Details on every new thing you're writing. And, if we can find you on social media.
I am on Twitter. At Guy Busick, and that's the best place to find me.
Cool.
And Scream is coming up next.
Woo! I'm looking forward to that.
January 14.
Is it just called Scream, or is
it? Scream.
Okay, gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Although the joke, of course, was replacing the S with a 5, and people just called it 5 Cream.
5
That was a joke on set.
That's really funny.
Which I love.
I love it. Yes.
It is called Scream. It is being released in theaters only by Paramount Pictures. January 14th next year.
Very cool.
And hopefully I'll be able to talk about and announce other projects on my Twitter account as they become announceable.
Guy Busick, such a good friend of mine. Thank you for coming in again.
Thank you for having me.
Guys, this has been the Secret of the Ooze, Electric Boogaloo, The New Batch. Guy Busick episode.
Thank you for Brentfest, Breck.
And with that, we put another stovetop Jiffy popcorn-worthy episode of Brentfest with Brent Pope in the old to-go bag. See ya.